Welcome to the Matt Haycock Show, a podcast about business, money, and life. Matt has been making money and making mistakes for over 20 years. And in this podcast, he shares his thoughts and stories so you can improve your business, finances, and life, whilst hopefully avoiding the mistakes he and others have made along the way. Listen in and level up.
I felt less rejected when I was rejected, because I made sure that there were other things in my life that were important, and hobbies and interests, that it didn't feel like this career or my job defined me.
Hey guys, it's Matt Haycock here, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycock Show. Now, so many of you guys message me asking how you build out a business and a life whilst following your passion, and quite specifically in the entertainment industry. So I'm really excited to say that I've got a brilliant guest for you today who you are going to love. Today's guest is a multi-award winning actress. She's been on our screen since she shot to prominence in the 90s as one of EastEnders' most impactful characters of all time, Mel Owen. And since leaving Albert Square, she's gone on to become more relevant than ever, starring in a host of West End productions and a host of UK and US TV shows in recent years. And what you might not know is that today's guest is also the voice for emerging acting talent after she was awarded an honorary degree for the services to the arts and entertainment industry by the University of East London. So welcome to the show, Tamsin Althwaite.
Thank you. Gosh, that's
a
real
very
intro.
Long intro, wasn't it? We haven't got time to talk now.
Gosh, it's great for my ego.
Listen, before, I guess when I do these, I always like to kind of go back to the beginning, you know, how it all started for you, and you know, if you probably imagine you'd end up where you are now, you know, back when you were a kid. But before we started filming, you and I were just about to talk about following your passion, following your dreams, or following the money. And you were going to answer me, but I wanted to stop because I thought that's actually quite an interesting point to start the conversation. Mm. And if we go back to you being a kid, when did you first develop a passion for acting? Was it what you always thought you'd do? And were you doing it for love, or were you doing it for money back then?
Oh, well, there was no question about money. I'd have done it for nothing, all of it. So it was always a passion. But it started with just a buzz that you get from being on stage. So that's when I knew that was something that I needed to follow. Whether that was going to be my job and my career, I didn't know then. But I did know that I needed to feel that feeling as much as was humanly possible.
How old were you at this point?
Gosh, I suppose it's on and off from the age of about 7 or 8.
Oh, really? And what you do, school plays? And...
Yeah, but, you know, nothing major. And it wasn't until I was 13 that I was at an amateur dramatic group. And that is where we would rehearse for 6 months of the year and then do, like, a week of shows at a theatre, but at a professional theatre. So that, like, working towards something, working on harmonies, working on songs, like putting something together where you're doing choreography. I mean, that for me was my intro into it. So that's when I knew, even if I was doing it once a year in an amateur dramatic group, I definitely loved it and wanted to do that. I didn't go to, like, drama school or train until I was 16. So I stayed at ordinary school, and then at 16 did a 3-year course in performing arts. So it wasn't until I was there that it was like, oh, this could be my job, my actual job where I earn a living. So yeah, that's how it started.
I guess it's kind of a nice lead in that when you say that this could be my job. And I always like to try and draw parallels, you know, between the business world and the world of some of my guests, if they're not directly related to business. But I guess what, you know, rings home to me with acting is that, you know, probably 98% of people who try to have a career in acting fail or can't get work out of it. You know, of the 2% of people that actually do start to get some work in it, you know, they probably spend 98% of their time out of work. And I guess, you know, it's probably even harsher statistic than the failure rate of startup businesses. Mm-hmm. How did that hit you? How did you feel about that when you started to try and look for work in it? And as you've kind of gone on with your career, I mean, I know you've been very successful, but there must have been times when when you've been out of work. And, you know, do you ever wonder if, you know, that last great job you did was probably the last piece of work you'll ever do?
Yeah, obviously there is a feeling which is, will I ever work again? But most actors you speak to will say, they'll finish a job and go, will I get another job ever again? Because it's a life of uncertainty. So, yes. But I think when I first started out, it was more about, like, I knew that it was longevity. It was never, I want to make it, because what is making it? In my head, making it or being a successful actor, actress, anything in the entertainment industry, I would say making it is earning a living from doing that. That is being successful for me. So if you can earn a living from your passion, that's making it. I don't think you have to be well known or famous to make it. You've just, you're earning a, your, you know, it is your proper job. And so I always knew that it was about the longevity of it and not about a quick fix, 15 minutes or, you know, you see an awful lot of people desperate to get to somewhere which is actually an imaginary place. So there's this imaginary ladder, this career ladder that you go up. And then here I am and I've made it. That doesn't exist, because then for a lot of people, that's like, it's not quite enough. So now I need to do film, or now I need to do. So I think the fact that I was really satisfied if I was working, I wasn't desperate to get somewhere. And I would have toured in productions, earning the money that I was earning at the beginning of my career. If I could continue that, I would have been probably quite happy. I mean, my ambition when I was at college was to be in Cats, the musical. And then when I eventually auditioned for it and got it, I got another job at the same time doing Summer Holiday in Blackpool with Darren Day. And it was £200 a week more money than Cats in the West End. And it wasn't that I followed the money. It was like...
You followed Darren Day.
I just wanted to work with Darren Day, who was lovely. But, you know, that is quite a weird fate thing, because I really was desperate to be in Cats because I loved the musical so much and I'd seen it 9 times. But when it came around eventually, it was like I'd already moved on to something else. So it was enough for me to know that that was my ambition and I could quite easily have achieved that had I taken that job. But I also knew that the reality of doing 8 shows a week in a show like that was, it would be, everyone I knew that was in the show was always kind of really pale and very thin, and they worked really hard. So I was quite excited about doing Summer Holiday, which had never been done before, you know. So it took me somewhere else. So yeah, if I wouldn't have got EastEnders, say, which would have led to opened all of those doors, I would have been quite happy doing theatre and working as much as possible for the rest of my life. I wasn't like, I desperately need to get to the top of this ladder and now I need to do that. It's maintenance. It's maintenance of your career and it's longevity. And if you want to be here as an actor, you know, in later life, that's how you see it. I don't see it any other way now.
So I guess something that kind of interests me, you know, what I've got thinking about from what you're just saying, and, you know, a lot of the time, well, all the time when, you know, we create these podcasts and I create content for my audience, it's normally about, you know, giving information and education to people at the beginning of their career or looking to move on up. But, you know, you talk about maintenance of your career and, you know, being able to earn a living doing something you love. And I guess, you know, something we always see is, you know, people who've been successful in a soap or successful as a UK actor, you know, packing up and leaving to Hollywood. And they're always you know, determined to kind of, you know, follow the dreams to, you know, to make it big in Hollywood. And I guess as the public, you know, 99 times out of 100, you know, we look at them and think, oh, we've got no right to say so, because what do we know? But I guess we just see that, you know, historically, everyone that gets up and goes to Hollywood doesn't make it.
A lot of them do, though.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess,
but we don't necessarily see the programmes.
Well, I guess,
yeah,
that's true. Yeah,
but they make a living out there.
Yeah, true. But I guess my question was kind of different to that, though. It was going to be to say, when you've got a successful career in the UK,
yeah,
I mean, would your advice be to someone to stay and maintain, and, you know, and keep that successful UK career, or to pick up, you know, and follow that dream that, you know, you've probably got a much higher failure rate of, and you may not even have anything to come back to when you come back to the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm quite staunch about the fact that I have tried it, in the sense that I went there for pilot season and it wasn't for me.
And why were you doing it? Was it scratching an itch or was it?
It was more that my agent had like somebody over there that was a manager who had said, you know, it was the right time. I'd left EastEnders, so it was just after that. I think I'd just done Red Cap. Red Cap was on over there. So it was in conjunction with the launch of Red Cap, which was a vehicle that was for me. And I suppose if it was going to happen, it needed to happen then. And I don't love the place, or it's more that I'm just not very good at it. I'm not very good at going into a room and bigging myself up how you have to in Los Angeles, because irony is lost on those people. So, you know, I do remember saying at one point, like somebody looked up and said, one of the people that I was auditioning for, have you won any awards? And I said, yeah, I have. I've actually won loads, but some of them are for having long eyelashes, because, you know, there were things like sexiest female in a soap that I won, like silly awards, you know? And so, and nobody laughed and they didn't see the irony. And they said, no, have you won any awards? And I said, yeah, no, sorry, I have won some. But, you know, they're not BAFTAs. A National Television Award for Best Newcomer. And they want you to sit there and big yourself up, but it doesn't sit very well when you're trying to talk about, you know, sexiest female in a soap or the Variety Club Awards, you know.
And how do you feel, you know, being successful, but then effectively almost like having to go back to zero every
That's
time you go
That's exactly what it was.
Audience.
So what was weird was that I was at a time in my career where it felt like scripts were being sent to me and work was coming quite thick and fast. It was quite a lovely time. Although when you look back now, you don't appreciate that then. So it is quite strange having to resell yourself. So you have to tell everyone you meet what you do. And, you know, they haven't necessarily seen your showreel. And there's a whole load of people doing exactly what you're doing. So the rawness that this country is very good at creating in actors, like, I don't know, it's not a polished look. You know, our teeth aren't all bright white. We aren't all surgically enhanced. And I found the whole world of auditioning very strange and not very authentic and sincere. And everybody was saying to me, nobody wants to say no to you. They don't want to say no. So they almost say yes. And so you leave every room thinking, I've just got that job.
Yeah.
I've just got that job. And I'd go back and speak to my agent and say, honestly, I can't quite believe it, but if they said they're going to be calling you in the next couple of hours to talk about the deal. And then you'd never hear a thing. And I think, I just would rather you just be honest and say, you're not for us, like they would hear. They would say, thanks very much. But you wouldn't necessarily be made to feel like you had every job that you auditioned for. I was like, oh my God, I'm cracking this. And then you literally never heard from them again. So I suppose it's the honesty, the truth, the authenticity, that when you step into a room in this country that I feel like I know what I'm getting.
And tell me, when you speak to, or when I speak to, let's say, a lot of successful athletes, you know, musicians, you know, those kind of people, you talk about their key characteristics for their success, and you, time and time again, you'll hear about the fact that, you know, they feel they may not have been the most talented person, but, you know, but they'll always outwork the next guy. You know, they'll be in the music studio for days on end without sleeping, or they'll be running and training right and sleeping right. But acting almost feels like, to me, something different, where you know, there's limits to how much effort you could put in. And I guess, and you started your career in a time long before social media, etc., where you know celebrities today can go from zero to, you know, mega success, millions of followers overnight. I mean do you think there are some key characteristics between, you know, great actors who just make a living and the ones who, you know, really hit the headlines?
Well, no, I think a lot of that's luck.
Right.
A lot of it is luck.
Right script, the right agent.
Yeah, and also, yes, I suppose, you know, getting your foot in the door on something, on a television programme where it suits you. I mean, you know, I really enjoyed doing 3.5 years in EastEnders, but the work that came after it was, you know, Red Cap, Hotel Babylon, that when there were series that were coming in thick and fast, and I was working most of the time 6 days a week from project to project, at least like 12, I was out of the house 12 to 14 hours a day. I wouldn't now, apart from kids, but I wouldn't now be able to do that. You know, there was definitely a moment where I felt like I could easily burn out if this goes on for many years. And there was a good period of at least 6-7 years where it was, there wasn't much of a gap in between projects. And the, I also do feel like you are conditioned as actors to take it while it's there. Strike while the iron is hot. So while you are in demand, take everything. Say yes to everything. And I almost had to train myself to be able to say no. It's okay. You can say no. You can hold on to your currency and wait until the next project. You know, there are things sometimes I see on TV or films and I think, God, I should have said yes to that. You know, not loads of things, but...
On the ones you should have said no to. I'm not saying anything you should have said no. But in general, can you actually see something and think, you know what, this is absolute shite, but I'm going to do it for the money anyway. But I mean, can you really tell before the finished product?
No, I don't think you... Well, I can't. And I've read a lot of scripts, but some things I think, gosh, that script is it's meaty and I can't wait to see what they do with it. And you might not have done it and you watch it and think, oh God, that's nothing like I imagined them, how I would have done that. But so I actually think that I'm not necessarily a great judge of some things, gosh, that have turned out brilliant, and you think, oh.
But I guess as well, to a degree, you've only got so much input in the process.
You absolutely.
Know? I mean, you're making your decision based on a script, but then you take the script, the editor's got his bit,
of course.
You know, the director's got their bit, and it all.
Why have they used that shot? Yeah. Oh no, you know, I know that I did it so much better, like about 10 times, and why have we got that? And oh, because they're dealing with that, because of the, yeah. So that over the shoulder needed to be, and then the continuity. So yeah, you are a part of the process, but it's not all about you, absolutely. But I think I've always loved being in a team effort. I don't like being the number one when it all falls on your shoulders. I really like being in a group. I like being an ensemble cast. It's less pressure in the right way. And I don't feel like I need to play the lead. You know, sometimes my agent would say things to me like, I've got you the and. And I'd be like, sorry? And he'd be like, so it's them, and Tamsin Althwaite. And I'd be like, but why is the and, why is that necessary? And he would look out for me status-wise because you're not playing the lead, but I've got you the and. So I never really understood all that because for me, I was working. And also I think I felt less rejected when I was rejected because I made sure that there were other things in my life that were important and hobbies and interests that it didn't feel like this career or my job defined me. And that helped because I always felt very lucky and grateful to be working. Because when I was at college, there were a whole load of people more talented than me that didn't work.
So, and I guess, you know, we talked about, you know, 6 or 7 years of having so much work on that, you know, you don't know where to look. Mm. I mean, what about some dark moments? I mean, have you had periods, I mean, you've been in the game for so long. I mean, has there been periods of time where you've actually have genuinely...
I think once I had children, you go into a different, and I suppose hitting 40 and having children at a similar time, because I didn't have my second till I was 41, so I left it quite late. I was very, very ready. But once you have children, as an actress that's like a lead actor in this country, I definitely noticed a change in the kind of roles I was offered. And a lot of that is to do with age, not necessarily being a mum, but... So things, definitely once you hit 40, it felt like things started to slow down. And I wasn't being offered quite as much, but...
And is that because Is that because you weren't being offered quite as much, or is that because, for whatever reason, that, you know, the majority of roles in life are, in film, in television, are between a certain age bracket?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Because it's not like on stage, you can always play much younger than yourself. But on screen, an awful lot of the time, they'll cast younger. So I suppose... Yeah, it was, and also if you're playing a juve lead, or, you know, people don't really, they weren't really employing people in their 40s to be falling in love with each other. That was happening in the 20s and 30s. So, and then I suppose the roles kind of changed. Then when New Tricks happened, which I was, I suppose, early 40s, that is when... I was like, oh, okay, now we've moved into this role, because then I was the boss of three distinguished elder gentlemen. And I suppose then, yeah. I mean, I basically have been very lucky. I haven't been like years out of work, or not even, this is the most out of work I've been this year, COVID. So since March, I haven't, apart from filming a few bits and bobs, I haven't really had a proper job.
And has that made you think differently about your, I guess, your future and your career? Not from an acting perspective, but, you know, I guess having this forced period out of work, you know, for probably the longest time in your entire career. I mean, has it made you think that you need to have some more strings to your bow?
Yeah, absolutely. But also I have other passions, and my other passions are property and art. And so at the moment, lockdown has made, like, I have these sporadic ideas where I'm like, oh, hold on one sec. So I've got that property and I would like to turn it into like a holiday home. And then what I'd love to do is sell that, remortgage that, buy somewhere by the sea. Then I become like someone that is, I love interior design. So buying somewhere, doing it up, and then renting it out for holiday lets. But I have these continuously, probably with or without COVID, but it's been more so. And because of the anxiety that this lockdown has brought and this pandemic has brought, I will sometimes wake up in the night at 4 a.m. and I'm then on Rightmove for 3 hours, or Zoopla for 3 hours. So trying to work out what the remortgage payments would be, and if it actually could, I could make a living from that, so I wouldn't have to rely on acting. So as much as I love acting, I love being on a set, I love being on a stage, I do have other passions that I could probably turn into my full-time business if I really put my mind to it.
What kind of skills do you think you've learnt from acting which are transferable into some of these other passions or into business? And, you know, what kind of parallels do you draw?
From acting?
Yeah.
I think the work ethic is something that I would never have learnt unless I had been being picked up at 5 something and not getting home till 9, sometimes later. And that work ethic, when you hear people saying, oh gosh, I'm so tired, you know, and their day is a 9 to 5. At that time when I was doing ridiculous hours for years on end, I remember thinking, oh my God, by the time you go to work, I've done half a day's filming, you know. So there was a certain amount of, like, I suppose my ethic of how hard I worked and then going home and learning lines, that means that I can pretty much do most, like, days in most other jobs. If I was to get another job, like do another, go and work in a bar for a bit, you know, it wouldn't feel like the hours were tricky. I do think that something like, I used to do car boot sales, and we'd go to Hackney to do them, but you had to be there at 4 a.m.
What were you selling? Stuff from your house?
Stuff that my mum and dad would find in their loft, and my old clothes, and, you know, everything. I always thought someone else's trash is someone else's treasure. So my trash could be your treasure, your trash could be mine. So, and I would go to car boot sales, and I would spend a lot of time buying stuff and walking around as well as selling my stuff. But, you know, people not wanting things. Oh, I can put a lick of paint on that and then I can sell that. And I would do a lot of that. But you had to be there at 4 a.m. And I just remember trying to get people to come with me to do it. And they'd just be like, what? 4 a.m. in a queue at Hackney Wick. And you sit in your car until they let you in at 6. Why don't you just go at 6? It's like, because you won't get in. You won't get to the queue is massive, and you've got to get into the queue to know you're going to get a pitch. It's £8 for a car, £10 for a van. Come on, my dad had a video van because he used to have a company called Rentertainment. And so we'd take the videos out of the van and we'd take the van to do a car boots out. But trying to get people to do it with me was just like, nah, they wouldn't. What, and how much would you make? Anything between 80 and 150 quid. Nah, not doing it. Whereas to me, like, look after the pennies and the pounds look after themselves.
I used to do them on a Sunday myself back when I was probably, you know, 18, 19.
Did you?
20,
yeah, that's when I did it.
And I mean, at first I sold some stuff from the house, but obviously being 18, 19, 20, I didn't have much left to sell. So at that point we started to buy product in, and I had a couple of mates that we'd do it with. And it was a similar setup. My, you know, was it Hackney?
Hackney.
Yeah, so my version was Pontefract Lane in Leeds. And we used to go to Pontefract Lane, and I used to borrow a van off my dad because he used to have a van with his business. And but what we'd normally do is we just go out all Saturday night, you know, finish in the club at like 3:30 in the morning,
go straight there,
pick the van up and sleep when we're in the queue. But what always used to stagger me is that, I mean, it is the epitome of a place where there is a price for everything.
Oh yeah.
I mean you can sell
anything.
I always remember I had this trestle table set up, and I was selling inflatables. This is like, do you remember 20 odd years ago?
Yeah,
they had blow up chairs, inflatable chairs, inflatable sofas. And I remember I had a bit of flu at the time, and I had a toilet roll because I had the toilet roll on the table, and this guy walks past and he looks through all my lovely array of multicoloured inflatable sofas, points at the toilet roll, he goes, how much for that? I says, I'm sorry. He goes, I'll give you 20p. I was like,
all right, take it.
Yeah.
Oh, there'd be a lot of things like people come over and be like, old Gucci shoes. Like, this is Essex, where I was brought up. So
They'll buy one shoe off
you. No, but they'd be like old Gucci shoes, and they'd go from like £20, and somehow I'd sold it for 5p, a pair of shoes, because one of the tassels was missing, and it got me down to 5p. But in the end, you just like, just take them, you know.
No, I was going to say it's a fantastic training ground for negotiation.
It's brilliant.
Being prepared to say anything to anyone. I mean, yeah. I mean there's no embarrassment. There's no fear at those car boots.
No, not at all. But also, I do remember, like, when we were kids, you'd be in an ordinary supermarket where you can't barter. And I remember my dad would do things like, how much? And it's like, Dad, we're in Sainsbury's. You can't barter here. You know, so it was very much a kind of market. You know, my mum always took me to the market, Ridley Road Market, Roman Road Market. And my dad knew lots of market traders. So there was very much a retail in a market was kind of like, I mean, it was probably my first Saturday job doing that kind of stuff before the car boot sales came in. But also as an actor, it was a brilliant place to study characters, because you would always have different people from different nationalities, all different ethnicity, and some of them would be there because they're looking for vintage Gucci, like women that, you know, they know, they've got a keen eye and they know what they're looking for. And then some people are coming in actually clothing their kids. So all sorts of people, all walks of life. And that was also most Sundays watching that. Was great. I mean, I've done them since. I've been like on the telly, should we say? And the last time I went, I put a wig on. But I did speak, and somebody heard my voice, because that's probably the thing, and started asking me, you know, why? Where do I know you from? And I was like, oh, I don't know. So, but I do kind of miss it.
Week.
Yeah, I think you were here last week. But I do kind of miss it. You know?
So tell me, going from car boot sale to, you know, I guess opening the letter or getting the phone call, however it works, to say that you're going on to EastEnders. I mean, you know, how do you feel at that time? You know, and I guess when did you first feel famous? When did you first feel successful?
Well, I remember Julia Crampsey was the casting director at EastEnders at the time, and she had called my agent and said, can you ask Tamsin to call us? We want to speak to her. And I'd done a workshop with, I think it was something like 20 girls, 20 boys, and they were casting two characters. And I remember thinking that it went quite well, but it was like half a day, so we were there for quite a long time. And then I forgot all about it. And that's the other thing, to train yourself to forget about it. You've done the audition, cancel, move on, cancel and continue. And then my agent, I had a pager at the time. Do you remember pagers?
I do.
So I had a pager at the time, and I was walking down Tottenham Court Road because I was in a dance group. And we used to dance at clubs. We had like, we'd rehearse and then we'd go into a club on a Saturday night and we'd be on the stage. And the Hippodrome we did. And that was how I was earning my money at the time. I'd done a lot of musicals and a lot of theatre, but I quite liked the, I mean, I really used to like doing a little bit of pretty much everything. So when I got this call, the pager went off and said, call your agent. And this was when in Tottenham Court Road Station they had rows of the old fashioned phones.
Yeah.
So I went to the phone box and I phoned him, and he said, oh, can you phone Matthew Robinson and Julia Crampsey? I've got the number for you. They want to have a chat to you. So I phoned them, and he said, Matthew said, Tamsin, I'm here with Julia. And he said, are you ready for your life to change? That's what he said. And in my head, I thought, oh, it's a little bit, for an exaggeration, it's just a 3-month contract, you know, because also when you got a job, it didn't mean that was, you don't go, oh, I've made it now, because I never had that mentality. I just thought, well, this is going to be my job for the next 3 months. So he said, are you ready for your life to change? And I said, why? What's happening? He said, we'd like to offer you the role of Melanie. And then Julie was in the background and I could hear her clapping and laughing and cheering. And I thought, this is brilliant. And then my mate lived up the road in Islington. And I remember going to get on the bus, 73, that was going to take me to Islington. And I just remember, instead of doing that, I thought, because I was working still at the time, and I just held my hand out and got a cab. And I remember that was a conscious decision of like, oh no, I've got a job and I'm going to get in this cab. And then of course, it was a 3-month contract with a 3-month option, which turned into 3.5 years. But that could have gone either way. Sometimes you go into a soap, a lot of people do that, and the character doesn't work or it doesn't sit well, or, you know, don't know.
But I guess, so you were practical and pragmatic enough to look at it, you know, not as making it, but a 3-month job. But then when that 3 months turned into three years, I mean, there must have been a point along that time where, you know, then you're starting to feel successful.
And yeah, I think it's because at the time when I started, it was twice a week it was on. And by the time I left, they'd gone up to 4 times a week. And you still had the Sunday omnibus. So if you think you're in people's homes for all of those hours, so it's half hour, that's 2 hours, and then the omnibus. So for 4 hours a week, you are pretty much at the forefront of people's minds, because in those days, everyone watched it, or they watched Corrie, one or the other. You had 4 channels. So it was, you know, millions and millions of people were watching it. Something ridiculous of the Melanie and Ian Beale's wedding. And I do remember feeling like everywhere you went, people did call you Melanie, and there was a feeling of, oh gosh, I can't do anything now without being spotted doing it, or, you know, there was definitely that. So losing your anonymity. Yeah.
So you just landed on EastEnders. I guess, like you said at the time, you were just looking at it as a 3-month job. But, you know, you're going to be surrounded by some pretty established cast and probably some people who've been on there for many, many, many years. I mean, did anyone take you under your wing? Did you kind of feel like you needed a mentor?
Well, Adam Woodyatt was really good and very kind and very lovely, because it's very, very fast moving there. And it was, I'd done a couple of TV jobs, but nothing as major as this. And he was just really warm and really like, I've got your back, don't worry. And this is that person, they're good to know, and they do this. And he told me everything about who was upstairs. And, you know, it took ages for me to learn people's names, not don't call Phil, because his name's Steve, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And Adam was brilliant. And then also I went in at the same time as Martin Kemp, and I knew my character was going to be somehow linked to both of them. So Martin and I also very, very, well, we were just working together the whole time. So we spent a lot of time together. But what I loved about him is he taught me something that I remember thinking that I took that through most jobs. But I never really needed it as much as I did in EastEnders, which was come in, know your lines, do your work. But then when it finishes, don't go and sit in the green room because you hear all the gossip and all the stuff you don't need to hear. And that instead, it just made me feel kind of, yeah, you're right, I don't need the extra nonsense, because there was a hierarchy and everyone was seemed really lovely, but you know, I was a bit scared of Wendy Richard and I was a bit scared of people. And if I heard them saying something, you know, it would make me feel really insecure. So Martin just said, do your stuff, get on set, do it, and then just go back to your room. And that was really good. It was hard. I'm quite a sociable animal, so I found that quite hard because I quite like having a laugh, and the banter and everything between actors can be, you know, hilarious. So, yeah, so he taught me that, and Adam was just, yeah, he took me under his wing. And I didn't feel like anyone was threatened, which was lovely. And I never really understood that, you know, when new people come in, you feel threatened by them. I always think, you know, just by shining a light on somebody else, it doesn't make you duller, you know.
And have you found that as obviously your career's developed, and you know, I guess you've become the elder statesman, right? Stateswoman.
Have you just old?
have you been mentoring people along the way, or have you?
Well, I'm at the moment on Ridley Road. There's a lovely girl called Aggie O'Casey, and she's literally still in drama school, and she's playing the lead of Vivian Epstein, and it's a fantastic role, and she is bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and she's got a lovely way about her that you think, I hope you never get jaded, or I hope you never lose this kind of the passion and the innocence about it, you know. And she's really enjoying it. So someone like that, you just want to protect, you want to wrap them in cotton wool and make sure they're all right, and just keep encouraging her. Don't ever feel like, you know, you don't deserve to be here. You deserve to be here, first job or not, massive role. Yes, you're still in drama school, but don't get, I suppose, don't get anxious about it. You're in safe hands and we've all got your back. So yeah, with her, with lots of people really, I like seeing new people coming up through the ranks. I think it's encouraging. And also, when I did Red Cap, I suppose, I felt very much like Douglas Hodge did that to me. So he was playing my boss in it. And it was the first programme that I'd done that where it was a vehicle, I suppose, for myself. And he was a really established, brilliant actor. And I learned a lot from him. Just whiteboard scenes. You know, everything felt like you were watching a master of his craft. And, yeah, he was a great mentor. I mean, I've had loads of mentors. Every job, you find someone that is inspiring or that you learn from. You never stop learning. You never go, oh, this is it now. Oh, I've done it. I know everything I need to know about it. You know, every job you do, you learn something else about how to hone your craft, you know?
Have you still had kind of formal coaching along the way? You know, as in, have you ever chosen to, I don't know, step back and, you know, take a particular lessons in dialect, or, you know, whatever it may be?
I have done jobs where there have been voice coaches, for instance. I did a musical, I went back to do a musical when I was 39, really heavy dance and song, and it worried me that I wouldn't be fit enough. And that was like doing dance classes all day, every day again, and singing classes, and the dialect as well, because it was an American accent. And you get dialect a coach when you're doing anything that is not your own accent, generally. So on Boeing, I was playing the American air hostess, yes. There have been moments where you are definitely back in a classroom, you know, or a rehearsal room, and you feel like you are learning a lot more than you would on a lot of jobs, I suppose. But trying different ways and being free with your script, it does feel like you are continuously learning anyway. So I suppose every job I do, trying things out differently, and also being open once you're on the set or on stage. So listening, reacting, listening to what's going on, and knowing that if they don't react to you, you could pull it back, or sure, you're in the moment, so you could improvise something. Or yeah, I mean, it excites me just talking about it because it is such a wonderful thing to do for a living. I do love it, especially when you are, you know, an actor. I love actors and I love crew. I like the banter. I like being on a set. That's why I think COVID's made things very difficult for your natural, the laughs, the larks.
No, I mean, your passion completely shines through.
Does it? Yeah, I do. I miss it when I'm not there, and I get very overexcited when I'm there, like a kid. Oh, I'm back! You know, and it's like you're not at home and you're not in your pyjamas, so, and you're out and in a costume. You know, it's... But, of course, there were times where the hours and the days would drag, and now, like, you're just relishing every moment.
And what, I mean, what other downsides of fame have you found? I mean, have you found that it's impacted, I guess, not maybe from a typecasting perspective, or that you've been so famous in certain things, it's made it hard to either get jobs or achieve things in other areas of life?
Well, I'm sure that there are jobs that I went up for where they might have said, no, we don't want someone from EastEnders, because it's a soap. So there's still a snobberism that comes with that. But I think what happened was when I left, I did two plays at the Royal Court Theatre, and you're trying to kind of not prove people wrong, but just make your work speak for itself and try and keep it classy, is what I was trying to do. Actually, it's very difficult because all through that so-called high profile times, you know, there's things like the hacking scandal, which I was involved in, and I was hacked for over a very long period of time, which eventually has knock-on effects on your relationships. So, you know, a couple of my relationships were really under the spotlight for quite a long time. And that's pressure on ordinary things. But I never felt the need to moan about it because so much more positive came out of it than negative. So really, you've got to have your head screwed on and don't do anything, you know, ridiculous, and take it as it comes, really, I think. I mean, having a very strong, solid family and friend support group is really important, because you see some of the kids go into shows like that and you think, you know, they're not going to cope with this very well because they might not, or they've got the wrong people hanging around them or whatever.
Have you got a lot of, I guess, you know, people in your close network now who've been there from day one, or have you accumulated some great friends along the way?
I've accumulated a lot of great friends along the way, but family-wise, we're quite a strong group. So I do have people from way back, but I also have friends from way back that somehow you outgrow. Not just you them, but them you too. And I've never had that thing where you think the amount of time you know someone is the measure of a friendship, because I've got some of my closest friends I've known not that long. So I like that. I don't, you know, it's,
I think,
quite...
For me, it's down to the experiences you share.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess, you know, the
and like-mindedness,
more...
you know, yeah. You know, I like to be around positive people as much as possible, because there's too much negativity in the world. So, and also, what's that saying about, you know, if you hang around, the company you keep is
you're the sum of the, you know, the five people you spend the most
That's
time
it.
With, or
That's
know,
exactly
whatever
it. Yeah,
similar
yeah,
analogy.
Yeah. That's true.
So obviously, yeah, you mentioned the phone hacking scandal, and I guess you know, a parallel in today's world is probably the soon to be, you know, played out Colleen Rooney and Rebecca Vardy case, and you know, rightly or wrongly, or you know, whoever's guilty of what, you know, when these situations play themselves out in the media, I guess you know, it must be very easy not to know who to trust, not to know where to turn.
Yeah, well, things like we'd be going away and only two of us knew where we were going and we wouldn't tell anybody else. And then it would appear in a tabloid. And so I definitely started to doubt partners of mine.
And presumably you pulled them on it at the time and said, right, you know, did you say this?
No, I just think I became very wary. We did talk about it a lot. I wasn't aware that you could hack people's answer phone messages. And it wasn't until I was left a message from a newsroom by mistake that I realised I was being hacked. And then years later, you know, it all came out and it did. But I know of people that were hacked around that time that stopped speaking to their own parents because they really believed that their own family was selling stories. So, yeah, it does. It tampers with your trust, paranoia. And now an awful lot of stuff makes sense years later when you find out what really went on. But it's not a nice feeling sitting in an office going through, you know, so many different stories of what came from hacking. It's like folders and folders. And then, you know, having to revisit all that and look at it all and go, oh, my God, of course. Of course it came from somebody listening to an answer phone message. I mean, I did, Lucy Benjamin and I kind of... We kind of stopped talking because she thought I was selling stories on her. But, you know, it was stuff on my answer phone where she'd be leaving a message and somebody would hack into that. I would never have I done anything like that. And we started working on, we worked together on new tricks and it was, she'd just found out about all her hacking and was going to court with it. And she said, I can't believe it. And she kind of apologised for stopping trusting me. She said, now I know exactly where it all came from. So yeah, it's it plays with your mind slightly.
Sure. So let's talk about work and work family balance, or you know, work life balance. This is kind of a question I get, you know, emailed a lot, and it's something that's always kind of quite prolific on social. I mean, I know you know we talked earlier. You had your kids probably a bit later in life, which maybe fitted around the fact that you didn't have time to do it when you were working so prolifically earlier on. But I mean, you know, COVID aside, you're still very actively working.
Yes.
How do you find balancing the kids, balancing your personal life?
It's what I've realised is it's now a continual juggle. But if you've got a good support network, I've got, like, my kids had a nanny from the moment they were born, because Flo, 3 months into, when Flo was 3 months old, I had to go back and do another series of The Fixer. So I was signed into that. So basically, I found Michelle then, and she has been almost like their other mum. It's ridiculous, but they adore her, and now 12 years later, she's still with us.
Oh, you've had the same nanny for 12 years?
So, and now she's got two kids, so my house is very busy. I know that even though she only works a couple of hours a day now, I know that I could very easily say, oh, I've just got this job. Could you come in and do a few more? Or so it's a juggle, but so far we're managing it. And she is the consistency in their world.
And how do you think kids have changed you as a person? I mean, do you think they've changed your outlook or the way you behave? You
know? Just nothing is more important. That's the only thing, I think. No job, no holiday home, or, you know, nothing would take me away from them where I didn't, like, live with them or I wasn't present. I, you know, there are many jobs that have come around that are 9 weeks in Toronto, 15 weeks in New Zealand, and I just couldn't make that work now. And also, I know that I would be there miserable, because I'd be like, this is, look how selfish I'm being, you know. Well, actually, if I can feed them and clothe them and keep them happy, I spend a lot of time trying to keep them happy, believe me, then it's more important than trying to work with this director who I've been desperate to work with for ages.
And, I mean, do they understand what mum does?
Yeah, of course. They don't, you know, they don't love it, although they did think when I did Dumb Breeding, because it was on YouTube, that I was a bit cooler. Because it was on YouTube. So they wouldn't like to sit on and put like BBC One on, unless it's Ghosts.
They don't watch the old EastEnders Omnibus?
No. I don't think they like seeing their mum crying or you know, being angry, or they'll watch it and they just don't like it. So there are some things they've watched and they find it, like Inside Number 9, they find it quite funny because there's a bit of singing and it's a bit silly. But no, if they see me like looking traumatic, no.
What would you say to them if they were looking for a career in acting, and what advice?
I just say it's just if it's a passion. See, the problem is you don't want your kids to have a career of uncertainty and a life of rejection, and so really you want to be able to say to them, please do something where you know that your career will be a given. Please train in something where you know it's going to be fruitful. But that would be really hypocritical of me, because I've loved passion, every minute of it, and you have to follow your passion. So if they were passionate about it, absolutely. I mean, they both play instruments on their, or they're learning, and that to me is the one thing. I never learnt an instrument, so I love that they do that. That I don't think they'll be academics. But
when we talk about following your passion, when do you think, you know, when do you think is the time that you maybe need to get realistic and think, you know what, I've followed this passion for so long, but I'm not homeless, I've not eaten in 3 weeks.
Oh no, I mean, I'm not a proud person in the sense that I would do anything to make sure that there was food on the table.
Right.
So I panic if I haven't got a certain amount of money in the bank, because I'm used to being able to save, so that because of this career, so that if I am spending 9 months out of work, I'll be okay. So although we all live hand to mouth in this profession, really, I do also feel like if we got to the middle of next year and I hadn't worked,
you'd be looking for something else.
Yeah,
I guess it was more less a question for you, but more your advice. You know. To other people.
I think you've got to be prepared to do anything. I've got two really good mates, very talented mates, leads in the West End, singers, dancers. I mean, the top of their game. Since COVID, all the theatres went dark, they have been delivery drivers as a pair in a van. And I offered them to go and stay in my place in the Cotswolds, because I said I'd read something about them as well. And she sung at my wedding. She sung at my mum's memorial, Anna Jane. And, you know, she's always been one of the most talented friends that I have. So to see them going, we've got two kids and a mortgage, so we're going to be delivery drivers because that's what's needed at the moment. And we know it's not forever. There's a lot of people that won't do that. Mm.
No, I mean, that's fantastic.
You know, and I always would do that. I don't see that as there's no status on work. Why? It's about earning a living.
And how have they felt about doing it? I mean, obviously, they've needed to do it to put food on the table.
Oh, well, they're not shameful.
There's no ego.
But I did say, go and stay at my cottage for a couple of days with the girls when you get a moment. And they said, do you know what? We don't have any time because we are working 6 days a week continuously to make sure that we don't fall behind. So the grafting that goes into it, and also, you know, 8 shows a week from what they were doing before, the grafting that goes into that is intense as well. But it's about, I suppose it's not having an ego about it, isn't it? It's about saying, you know, one minute I might be tap dancing and singing a top C at the same time, and the following day I'm delivering to Amazon parcels or whatever. So yeah, I don't think I'm selling stuff on Spock and Depop at the moment. I have clear outs of most of it I take to the charity shop, but there are bits that you think, no, I can't just take that. So I pop them on and go to the post office and send them off. And there's something about that is quite rooting.
What is that Depop? Because my daughter always does it. Girls, you know, like swipe up, I've just put these clothes on Depop. What is it?
So Depop's a bit like eBay, but it feels less like aged. I can't even work
is
out
Is it just
eBay.
For clothes?
No, I think it's a lot of things. But my daughter buys stuff on it and sells stuff on it as well. And
this is like your digital version of a car boot sale, isn't it? This is car boot sale 20 years on.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, if you get the lighting right and get the photos good, you can make a few quid. Yeah.
So going off on a slightly different tangent, talk to me about your honorary degree. How did that come about?
That's a joke, isn't it? That's the only way that my parents ever would have got a photo of me in a cap and a gown by somebody handing it to me. It did feel a bit like I'd cheated, because it was me and Damon Albarn, I think, in the same year that both got them. And they ask you to say something. And I actually read out a poem, How to Be an Artist by Sark. And that's also about following your dreams, taking moon baths and living outside the box. And there were so many, giving out all of the diplomas and the degrees, but people were coming up and I felt a little embarrassed, even though I had my hat on and gown on. Because I felt like, you've just done 3 years, and I've just popped off, stood on this lectern, and I don't know. I loved it, because it was like, gosh, really? But at the same time, you feel like you've cheated somehow. But yeah, my photo is very proudly on the wall at home.
And do you have any, do you have some responsibilities that come with it, or do you have to, give something back, or?
No, I mean, on the day that I was called in, I think I've been invited to something since then, but they give them out to different people each year. So, I'm already a has-been.
Well, I've got some stats in front of me about the arts here, right? So 363,000 people work in the UK arts. The industry is worth 10.8 billion to the UK economy, which is 2.8 billion for Treasury and the taxation. And it generates a further 23 billion a year from knock-on. And I guess, so for anyone listening to this after the fact of recording it, or listening after we've recorded, we are here in October 2020, mm-hmm. Well in the middle of COVID, probably round two or round three of COVID problems. Obviously, those stats are astronomical figures to the UK, and particularly over the last few weeks, there's been a lot of high profile celebs from the arts, expressing their anger, let's say, towards Boris and Sunny, and their attitude towards the arts, the lack of support. Do you think it's a focus lack of support of the arts, or just the fact that they haven't got a clue what they're doing across the board? I have various investments, some quite heavy ones in hospitality, another sector which has been completely overlooked.
And, yeah.
I don't think that they've particularly chiselled out hospitality and said, fuck them. But I just think they haven't got a clue what's going on.
No, I agree. I don't think they've got a clue. But also, that's a knock-on effect as well. When we are in the West End now, there is no theatre. Mm. So therefore, the restaurants and the hotels, people come to London to see theatre because it's the best in the world in this country. So I'm not just London, the whole country. The regional theatres as well. But if you've got hotels that are putting up tourists or just people that are travelling to London to see theatre, and there are restaurants all around that serve meals, pre-theatre meals, post-theatre meals, without the main central character, which is theatre, everything else suffers. Transport, taxis, black cabs. It's ongoing, the knock-on effect. Apart from mental health of the majority of the country, because there's no outlook and the people that work in it have nowhere to put their creativity. So, as well as financially, obviously. Now, yes, there was a bailout package. I don't know anyone that's seen any of that money yet. I do know that it has been given to theatres now and it's starting to trickle down. But I don't know any performers, any actors, any performers, any singers, any musicians, dancers that have received any of that money. And we are talking about an awful lot of people that were already on quite a low wage, but as you say, it makes a lot of money for the country and it makes more revenue than Premiership football. Now, that sounds weird, but it's true. I don't think they really have worked out how important it is to the country, just the arts generally, but the theatre especially. So, yeah, I was in a play at the Playhouse when we all went dark on March the 16th, The Seagull, with Jamie Lloyd's company. And the whole rehearsal process was talking about, oh, this many deaths today and that many. So we knew that there was going to be Broadway closed, and we knew that surely we were going to follow.
Were you live at this point?
Yes.
Okay.
So we'd done five shows. We hadn't got to the press night yet, but we'd done five previews. Amelia Clark playing the lead, lots of brilliant actors, having a great time. But generally, in theatre, it's not... Actors and dancers and singers don't make loads of money doing theatre. But the passion and the love for it is so dense, and it's just so rich that without it, it feels like there's an awful lot of people feeling bereft. You know, it's like someone's died. And I know lots of people have. I just feel like it's not getting... If we can travel on planes with masks on, we can sit in a theatre with masks on, is what I think. There must be ways around it. I know people are now working out ways around it, but at first I thought it's going to be a lot of one-man shows, one-woman shows. But I think they will work out a way. Now, television is coming back, and the thing I'm doing at the moment, Ridley Road, we're having tests whenever we film. And
just talking about the monetary side of that, I mean,
yeah.
Are the kind of jobs that people are getting now in television, are you getting the same kind of money you would if this
no,
was...
No, no, I think that what... there's been an awful lot of stuff happening over this COVID that you do for no money. People want to be creative, they want to keep working, and people are doing things for nothing. Of course, the big production companies, BBC One, Red Productions, they're paying, you know. But I think there's an awful lot of people out of work. So people are more willing to work for less at the moment because they're missing their passion. They're missing their job. They're missing creating. And that's me just talking about the people at the forefront. You know, in every one of those theatres, they have all the front of house staff, all the people that work backstage, the lighting, the riggers, the stage door people. It just goes on and on. The wig people, the makeup people.
Well, it goes even deeper. I think, you know, what a lot of people don't even realise. So you talk about how lack of theatres or lack of cinemas, that then means lack of restaurants. But then, you know, when you have lack of restaurants, then the food suppliers who are supplying those restaurants, you know, they're also supplying schools or nursing homes or whatever it may be. And, you know, and a vast amount of their business is underwritten by the leisure industry, by the arts. So then ultimately, you know, if you're I don't know if you're supplying seafood or whatever you supply, if you lose 20-30-40% of your turnover because you're not supplying to the arts and leisure anymore, ultimately, do you even have a viable business to then be able to supply the people that are open?
That's
one example. We can
yeah.
go on and on and on,
I know.
And on and on. And I know, yeah, we're not here to get political.
No,
but
I mean,
you know, I your comment. Why can we sit on an aeroplane if we can't sit in the
yes.
theatre?
Yes, I also think that it's extremely frustrating to watch a lot of people struggling with their mental health at the moment. So, and I think that on the back end of all of this, please God, this will all be over soon. I think there's a lot of work to be done to bring people back to health and to get over what we've just been through or what we're going through now, to recover as an industry. And it's not just artists. Generally, all of us are going to need to spend a lot of time looking after ourselves after this, I think.
So you mentioned property quite a few times, you know, while we've been talking, and it obviously plays a big part in your life, I guess, both from a passion and a financial investment perspective. I mean, how did you first get into it?
So my mum always had a keen eye, and she was a mortgage advisor, and she advised me to buy a place when I was about 19. And I remember I put down £4,900 because it was £49,000 and you were allowed to put 10% deposit. And I still own that flat. And I'm the kind of landlady now who I probably could charge more But I've got my brother in one flat, a cousin in another, my nanny, a good mate, because as long as the mortgages are being paid, I know that, you know, the value of them are going up while they're there.
100%. I mean, yeah. It's always very easy to say, oh, you know what, this property's, you know, it's grown and we're due another 50 quid a month here, 100 quid a month there. But I think it's so easy to end up with revolving door tenants with people who smash the place up.
Absolutely.
That extra 100 quid a month here and there is, you know, is lost 50 times over with the wrong tenant.
Decent tenants is really important. And I'm a really fair landlady, so... You know, we keep an open dialogue about most of it. But the main thing is that I found a passion for it because my mum and I would sit on Rightmove and look at floor plans. Floor plans were everything. And then there was a time when she was a kitchen designer. So those squares, I just remember that paper with all the squares and how you would draw, how you would design a kitchen. So she always loved it. And I suppose my love for it came from her. I would always go and see property when I was on holiday because in my head, you know, I was going to move out there at some point. It only lasted about 5 minutes, that idea. But I would go and see places sometimes that I had no intention of buying because I would get design ideas and I would always be able to see by walking into a room, if I could knock that wall down, how I could extend that out, like what was underneath the carpet. So seeing beyond the decor was something that I got from my mum. So every place that I've bought has pretty much been not that desirable when you first see it. And I've done the work over the years so.
And do you think that interest in doing things up is kind of what led to your interest in investing in art as well?
Well, it came from that, weirdly, but I had some money to put down a deposit on a flat and I was going to buy a flat. And I was pregnant with my first child. And I always say that I got, when people get cravings, I don't know what happened to me, but I just got cravings for art. And I started pregnant, going around galleries. Like, you know, I'd be 8 months, massive, just walking around galleries, looking at things. And then I got into online art galleries, started buying pieces, got really urban art, I suppose. And I met a couple of artists and I started finding out of my friends who really liked art as well. I mean, now in these times, what I've been doing is selling it again because suddenly possessions feel weird and the experiences, travel for me is more important and to make my home as best as it can be. But I don't need the possessions. I don't need to look at the wall and see that piece of art.
And when you were buying them originally, I mean, did you kind of know? I mean, I don't mean know, but did you feel strongly they were going to go up or were they pieces?
Not all of them. I have definitely been stung on a few. A couple of artists kind of lost their value. And a few really, I've done really well.
The thing I used to buy quite a lot of art, probably, I mean, I've bought the odd piece over the last 4 or 5 years, but probably not for 5 years I've been buying. So where I find I used to get hit the most, and, you know, I always say you don't learn anything till you lose money. And I've managed to lose a lot of money. So I guess I've learned quite a few things along the way. But what I used to find with art was that the... particularly the more emerging artists, the commissions involved for the galleries and the dealers are so astronomical, and I get why they need to be because without those dealers and without those galleries pushing them, you know, there would be no emerging artists in the first place. But when you look at these people taking 50%, sometimes more commissions out of it, these pieces by definition need to double just for you to get your money back.
So you've lost money on them. Yeah. I've definitely done that on a few pieces, without a doubt, because I bought them from galleries. Then I went through a phase of buying them on eBay, you know, and trying to make sure that they were authentic and I had COAs for all of them. And now I'm taking a lot of pleasure in selling them, getting rid of them. Also, for some reason, I was pregnant.
At a profit or just you, it's just time for them to go?
Some of them are profits and some of them aren't. I mean, I don't get too stressed about it because what I've made on one, I've lost on another, and it, you know, that's what happens. But to have a craving for art when I was pregnant and buying lots of art that was really aggressive, like guns and skulls and like colours and nothing that looked peaceful, which is a really weird thing to do when you're nesting and you're pregnant for the first time. I did have a bit of sciatica, so maybe it was an angry pregnancy. I think they were both angry pregnancies. I think hormonally, it's easy to get angry when you're really raging with hormones. But no, I did. Now when I look at them, I don't want them up on my wall because they just look angry. And so, and I've got two girls. So yeah, I'm really over I'm over possessions, you know. I sold jewellery way back. I got rid of, like, you know, the jewellery that represents a time in my life. Some people would say I'm a massive hoarder because my house is full of things. I can't walk past a junk shop or a vintage shop without getting something, and it's normally crockery. But I don't want the art. It feels ostentatious and a bit gauche to have something on the wall that is a lot of money at the moment, or might not get a lot of money for, you know, who knows. But the fact is, the possessions feel, I'm just getting rid of it all.
It's funny what you say about, you know, the hoarder. I mean, I wouldn't call myself a hoarder, but I do seem to accumulate shit around the house. but as much as I've got all the shit, there is literally not one thing I wouldn't happily walk away from tomorrow. And I always say, as long as I've got my iTunes account and my passport, I'm happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I agree with that. But I still quite like some of my antique crockery. There are certain bowls I wouldn't want to get rid of.
And after this, what can we see? What can we see for you?
Oh.
What does the future hold? The rumours for Strictly and I'm a Celeb don't seem to go away.
No, I know.
But you're going to be in Wales now, not
apparently.
Not Australia.
I've had If I was going to do it, I'd definitely want to do the Australia one. No, I mean.
Well, you won't be allowed in Wales now, will you?
They're
keeping the Brits out.
What's happening? I don't know.
I don't know.
I've even had my aunt phoned me the other day and actually said, Tam, I'm having lunch with the girls. They said they swear you're doing I'm a Celebrity. I was like, Sandra, she said, I told you, she'd have told me. So, no, I've never even had a conversation about it. So I don't know where it comes from, but it's like many things. I once read that I used to go up with the drummer from Dodgy. Never met him. So, yeah, lots of things get said that aren't true.
But anything in the pipeline you can tell us about?
Oh, so Ridley Road is what I'm doing for BBC One and Red Productions. Sarah Soleimani script, still filming at the moment. And I film my stuff in December, and I've just done a couple of days. And that's lovely because it's all a 60s, swinging 60s, London, Soho. And I play Barbara, who is a hairdresser in the swinging 60s. The clothes are great, the hair's high, you know, and it's about fascism, it's about a Jewish girl and what they all went through. Dumb Breeding is still on YouTube at the moment. We're hoping that at some point we get back to The Seagull.
Was that a YouTube-only show, was it?
Yeah. And it was all done in lockdown. So okay. We did 9 episodes. So it's about 6 women going through the menopause. I bet you'll love this.
I've not subscribed to that one.
No, you should have a little look. You might learn something.
Well, I will be sure to check it out.
You should. It's quite funny.
Well, listen, thanks a lot for being here. It's been fantastic to chat to you. Loads of different topics and loads of interesting points of view, as I knew to expect. So thank you very much. Guys listening and watching, make sure you check out Tamsin on YouTube. Now, she is cool and down with the gang, just like me. And if you don't already subscribe to this YouTube channel, press subscribe, press like, and make sure you check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and everywhere else that you can find me on social. And I will look forward to seeing you again in a future episode. Thanks again, Tamsin.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Matt Haycock Show. For more Matt, check out his YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Matt Haycock. Or go stalk him on Instagram and Twitter, The Matt Haycock. And we'll see you soon.